Rescue me before I sink, lose the ship at sea.
Listening to episode 5 of Double Cross Radio on UCY.TV. Today is October 4th, 2012. If you know your CB Radio 10 codes, today is a big 10-4. My name is Drew Lamb, and I'm joined by my co-host, Freedom Lovers Chuck Horton and David West. We're coming to you live from the sovereign nation of Jefferson. Once again, I'd like to express my gratitude to our friends who have helped us make this show happen. Our producer, Jules, at UCY.TV, Doug Hill and his band Nothing Error, and our first guest, Colorblind Justice, who'll join us again for another show, hopefully within the next few weeks. Tonight, we're going to really dig into the inspiration for this show. All of us here at Double Cross Radio are history buffs. Last week, Chuck told us the story of Sitka Pass. Tonight, David is going to do what he does best. He's going to tell us a story. And that story is about some rebels from Northern California and Southern Oregon who imagined a new state within the Union. We will also discuss sovereignty, nullification, and our current hot topic, free trade. But first, let's cover some nuke news and check the radiation weather. The multiple nuclear meltdowns at Fukushima continue to rage on. Typhoon Jellawat pounded Okinawa with winds so strong that cars were blown around like leaves on an autumn day. About 8 inches of rain poured on Fukushima. The plant has been getting rattled by earthquakes, including a 6.2 on Monday, but fortunately the spent fuel pool at Reactor 4 has not yet collapsed. However, I have observed steam and smoke rising from the ground near Reactors 3 and 4. Last year, the Japanese government seized control of the media in an effort to censor news about the nuclear disaster. News agencies were forced to get approval from the government before releasing information about Fukushima. And internet service providers were forced to scrub their servers of sites containing data related to the power plant meltdowns at Fukushima Daiichi. The Japanese media has even engaged in reckless propaganda campaigns to encourage residents to consume the local food. One TV show host, Asuka Norikazu, gorged himself on vegetables from Fukushima Prefecture on his show. I won't be doing that. He is now being treated for acute leukemia. Nuclear power plant consultant Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds is now recommending that the Fukushima Daiichi site be encased in concrete and dealt with in a few hundred years. This was the solution that was implemented at Chernobyl. However, the sarcophagus around the Chernobyl site is breaking down and new releases of cesium-137 are being detected by scientists. There truly is no end to these disasters and no known cure. It is important that we adapt and learn how to cultivate safe food and mitigate our exposure to radioactive contaminants. You can learn more at FukushimaFacts.com. And now for some radiation weather. The current Geiger count in the state of Jefferson is 58 CPMs. The highest Geiger count that I observed on Radiation Network today was 60 CPMs in Portland, Oregon. Since the decommissioning of Trojan, Oregon does not generate its energy from nuclear power, but Reed College in Portland has a research reactor that is operated by students. Yes, indeed, students at Reed College operating a nuclear reactor. The lowest count that I observed was zero near Austin, Texas, but that might have been a malfunction. I did notice that New York had a count of 8 CPM, so Jules is in good shape up there. Another weather-related doom and news. I took some pictures of some chemtrails on Saturday that had created a crisscross pattern across the sky that extended beyond the Cascades. I watched a movie that night called Why in the World Are They Spraying that reveals compelling evidence that the government is promoting geoengineering as a tool to stop global warming. but is actually being used to disrupt weather patterns, destroy crops, and create massive profits for commodities traders. This is real stuff, and the EPA even discusses it on their website. Geoengineering involves the spraying of heavy metals and aluminum high in the atmosphere to reflect sunlight away from the planet. This procedure depletes the ozone layer and will actually contribute to global warming. Fallout from the chemtrails has also been damaging crops, and Monsanto has responded to this by developing aluminum-resistant crops. No government or company has the authority to pollute the air and manipulate the weather. This represents the greatest encroachment upon property rights imaginable. Write your congressman and demand action. We're being bombarded by air crap. Between the GMOs and the food, the radiation from the power plants, and the geoengineering, we are under assault. One of the goals of this show is to provide solutions. Elitist psychopath Hank Kissinger once said that if you control the food, you control the people. Liberate yourself and be food independent. If you can't plant a garden or build a greenhouse, then support your local farmers. Shop at the co-ops, go to the farmers markets, or participate in the CSAs. Through community-supported agriculture, you can buy crops that are grown just for you. I have an aquaponics farm called Pyramid Pure Foods, located in Ashland, Oregon. At my farm, everything is grown indoors in a controlled environment. I only grow heirloom crops. I don't grow a GMO seed, and I don't use pesticides or herbicides. My fish, worms, and black soldier flies provide all of my fertilizer. My standards exceed organic, as I even test all inputs to my farm for radiation. I'm offering everyone an opportunity to secure their food independence by subscribing to Pyramid Pure Foods CSA program. Through the CSA program, you have a customized package of crops delivered to you each week. You can even participate in our composting program. For more information, you can email me at doublecrossradio@gmail.com. I also wanted to note, while I was talking, I was looking at the TEPCO cam at Fukushima, and it's showing the melting down reactors, and there's clouds in the sky. It looks like a typical day in the Northern Hemisphere. But I haven't seen clouds around here for a long time, and it hasn't rained since June, I think. And this has been unusual weather. I've seen these odd chemtrails in the sky, and then they spread out in kind of a reflective gray-like cloud cover. Doesn't look normal. Sometimes they look iridescent. And we didn't even have the thunderstorms that we usually have around here in August. Do you guys know what I mean? It wasn't that weird. We had like late summer with no thunderstorms.
Well, I'll correct you a little bit. We did have one batch of thunderstorms come through, but it was mostly dry lightning. There wasn't any moisture in the clouds. It was just has been no moisture since June, and that wasn't very much. It's almost going back to April.
I know that David tries to stay away from anything that could possibly be associated with conspiracy theory, so I'm not going to press him on this issue unless he wants to weigh in on his thoughts. You know,
I'm not that averse to conspiracy theories. I think there's some fairly compelling evidence. I'm always, a little up in the air on these things. But I know I've seen video of was it Eric Holder? No. It was whoever the Obama science czar guy is.
John P. Holdren.
Yeah, him. I've seen video of him talking about, oh yeah, we're using, high altitude aerosol spraying or something to try to affect weather modification. And I mean, weather modification is such a huge thing. It's like, that someone's at least researching it. So it's not a stretch at all to me to think that, chemtrails are happening in one form or another.
Well, some of the technology was pioneered here in Jackson County at the Jackson County Airport. And back in the 1960s, they started seeding and they'd spray dry ice to clear the fog. And
yeah, they still do that.
Yeah, I think a few years ago the FAA told them to stop because they thought it was dangerous that planes were taking off in the fog. And so they had to stop doing it. I don't know why they don't take off from another airport, like in Ashland or something, and fly in and do it. But you don't see those little specks of ice anymore like we used to see. You know, like when I was a kid, you'd see it kind of looked like small hailstones.
And almost like miniature snow.
Yeah, and then the fog would clear. So that technology was actually invented here in Jackson County because we have really bad fog problems due to the air pressure, and I think it has a lot
air inversions.
Yeah, and I think it has a lot to do with the mills too, and their kilns that they use to dry the lumber. They produce a lot of steam, but it is apparent to me that the government is tinkering around with geoengineering. The question is why? Why are they doing it? And it's been used as a weapon too. It's pretty easy to seed for clouds and to build clouds and make it rain. And that technology was used during the Vietnam War to create floods and wash out bridges and flood villages. So it's nothing new, but now they're trying to reflect light from our planet and cool things off. Or, you know, they could do things. They could create rain in one place and drought in another, just completely decimate farmland and then buy it up cheap and then let the weather patterns return to normal. Play the commodities market. You know, if you're going to destroy a crop, you know the prices are going to go up, you know, on what's left.
So those people do, and those big government people do believe in supply and demand in the long run.
Yeah, for them, yeah, capitalism for them and collectivism for the rest of us, I think, is what they want. Did you guys, I'm changing the subject here, did you guys watch the election last night? Or not the election, I mean the debates, excuse me.
No, I didn't. They didn't let anybody I was interested in hearing debate, so
yeah,
I abstained.
I'm not interested. I know that David isn't interested. I figured it'd be like watching a snake eat itself. You know, what was the point? So let's see. Let's do a quick mic check here. Can you guys hear me all right?
Yes. Oh, loud and clear.
Okay, I'm hosting this call, so I just want to make sure everything's working all right. So, Chuck, what else do you have on your mind tonight?
Well, I'm not monitoring the chat room that closely, but I did notice that we had a comment. There was somebody disagreeing with my take on free trade being a good thing, and they said that if you open up trade for everything, that you're going to just be selling America down the river. And you know, that's I don't want to say that someone isn't entitled to their own opinion and that isn't a possible outcome, but I did want to point out some things historically that have happened with trade protection. So, and I did post a much longer thing on our website so someone can read it. But I'll give you the Reader's Digest version of it right here and kind of call everybody's attention. This is something that you can go and research on your own. It's not very hard to find out this information. I think there's several economic sites that have information about the steel tariffs that were imposed at the beginning of the first Bush term in office, George W. Bush. Think about early 2001. And this put a 20% tariff on all imported steel. We was trying to protect the steel industry, protect those high-paying steel factory jobs. And as were to happen, as soon as he signed this bill that created this 20% tariff on steel, that night, overnight, the prices for steel in the United States went up by 20%. I don't know how that just happened to coincidentally be the same amount that the tariff was. But, what happened? All those great steel factory jobs looked like they were going to continue on. They were protected, and everybody was pretty happy. But everybody wasn't really that happy. But the people that weren't happy had trouble getting their unhappiness put out in the press or in the news. And I'm going to give you an example. Say you were a manufacturer of lawnmowers. Now, a lawnmower isn't that hard to build. You put a small engine on top of it to drive a propeller to cut grass. and you have it in a steel housing, which you stamp out. Well, if the price of your steel goes up 20%, that's going to make your lawnmower more expensive than it was before. And as we know from laws of economics, when things cost more money, fewer people buy them. And they turn to imported products, which did not have that same problem of having to pay the extra 20% for their steel. So it made all the imported lawnmowers seem cheaper, or less expensive, I should say, because cheaper denotes kind of a quality, but it made them seem less expensive for the same product than the ones that were produced in the United States. So all the people, who had these companies making lawnmowers, they were kind of faced this, they were between a rock and a hard spot. They had a choice, and neither choice was good. They could just call it quits and, basically liquidate their factory and their holdings and go out of business, or they could try and compete with their foreign competition that had a real huge advantage over them in terms of price, because their raw materials were quite a bit cheaper than theirs. So, they really had no winning choice that they could make, a winning decision that they could do. Now, you say, well, so what? We lost some lawnmower producing jobs. Well, there are a lot of things in this country that are made out of steel, like cars. In the car industry, they had so much money invested in their factories and their plants and the manufacturing of parts and everything else that they couldn't just say, oh, we're going to liquidate this and go out of business. It just isn't going to happen. They have to deal with this as a reality. Well, they started to bleed red ink. I mean, just hemorrhage red ink. And they went back to Congress and said, you have to get rid of these tariffs. It's killing us. And the tariffs were revoked. But a lot of damage had been done. It takes a lot of work to build yourself into a market, to get that perception of quality and good value and all that stuff built in people's mind. And in just a short period of time, that had all disappeared because of that tariff on steel. So they saved some jobs in the steel industry, but all the things that I've read on it said that for every job in the steel industry that they saved, they lost 7 other manufacturing, good-paying manufacturing jobs, in things from lawnmowers to automobiles to everything else made out of steel. And the tariff was rescinded, but these jobs were gone because a lot of those businesses didn't come back. And it was just a horrible thing. Protectionism is not good for anybody. Free trade and competition is what is going to bring you prosperity. And the competition, we're not afraid of competition if we're on a football game. We certainly shouldn't be afraid of it in economics. If we have the freedom to do and to innovate and to produce things and to own the fruits of our own labor, that's a challenge. We take it on and we create a better way to do something. Like Henry Ford created the assembly line. And that just came out of an inspiration, because he was trying to figure out a way to do make his cars less expensively with less labor. He's trying to figure out a way to bring the cost down. Well, those types of innovations happen all the time if you have the freedom to do it and if there's competition for those products. And I think if you have the most freedom, competition is something you should bring on and welcome, because it will allow you to eventually be the winner. So that's all I had to say about that. And I don't try and force my views on anyone. And I just wanted to defend what I was saying with an actual case. And I hope that the people that think that tariffs are beneficial would go and do some more reading and research, try and get some other points of view and to really consider it before they make up their mind for sure. And they can decide whatever they want. I'm not trying to tell them how to think. That's certainly against my philosophy. But I wanted to bring that out, and I posted it on our webpage on Facebook, and so you can read the whole thing. And that's all I had on economics tonight.
Well, one thing I wanted to comment on is, the competition in the marketplace. I recently had an idea for a product that I wanted to have made, and so I wanted to see how much it would cost to get it made, and how long it would take, and all those details. And so I went on Alibaba.com, and you could get on that website, and you put some details about your product on there, and companies around the globe can bid on your product. They could bid to produce your product. It's supposedly a totally open and free market. Well, I got a lot of bids, but they were all from Chinese companies. There weren't any American companies that bid or even tried. Nobody even tried to bid. Not a single American company was interested in producing the product. And I was looking through that site, you know, and all the different kinds of things you could have made or sourced, and they were all Chinese companies. The thing is, like, most anything you buy now is made in China, and it's usually horrible. It doesn't do what it's supposed to do, or it doesn't last very long. And people complain about the quality, and they say, well, they use slave labor and that's why things are cheap. But I think they use bad quality materials as well, and in some cases they substitute to get the prices down. You know, if you're an entrepreneur and you approach Walmart to sell your product, they just really beat you up on price. They push really, really hard to get that price point where they want it. And so that gets passed along. And so the entrepreneur has to figure out how to get that price down, how to make it happen. So they go to the lowest bidder. And you end up with products like, I recently bought some kitchen hand towels. And the price seemed really good, and they felt like they were really good quality. I know a thing or two about textiles, and I thought, well, okay, these are great, and I'll buy a bunch of them. And I took them home, and I tried to use them, and they wouldn't wipe up liquids. You'd spill some water, you'd try to wipe it up, try to wipe off the table, and because they were made out of polyester, they weren't made out of cotton. But they looked like good towels, and I think that this is what happens through the whole bid process, you know. And these Chinese companies go and say, well, yeah, we could do that. We could do it for this price, you know, and or we can make it from this material and it'd be this price. And it looks and feels the same. And then you get it to the store and it sells. And then the product doesn't even come close to doing what it's supposed to do. And I run into that again and again and again. And tools don't last as long as they did. I own tools that belong to my great-grandfather. But I can't buy tools now that would last even through the rest of my life.
You can, but those tools are worth a lot more than most people are willing to pay. And you have to go to almost a professional source for the tools like that would be sold, maybe like a carpenter store or a, you know, really professional woodworking place, someone who creates equipment for cabinet shops and things like that. It's you, if you're going to go and buy stuff, I'll use an example. Quite a few people have those apple slicers. We just put them on top of an apple and it cores the apple and slices it into about six or eight pieces or whatever. And I love those. I think they're great. Bought one at the dollar store. It was from China one time and used it once. That's as long as it lasted.
Yeah.
So you can't depend on anything made in China.
Yeah, I've purchased things like
Some of you may have seen that. It was a great movie. It's based on a true story. The guy that got his arm caught between two rocks when he was climbing, and he had to cut his arm off. Tried to do it with his little all-in-one tool, but it was a just cheap Chinese thing, and he couldn't even pierce his skin with it. He couldn't even cut his skin. Mm-hmm. It was that bad of a product. And just things that you're going to depend on, yeah, I would say no. Yeah, but along with free trade, you know, that's the marketplace. I think I don't shop at Walmart very often. I certainly won't buy food there. It's not cheaper there. It's actually a little bit more expensive, and they have crap for food. They don't have good food.
Yeah.
We have other competing grocery stores in Medford that have lower prices than Walmart, so they're not always the lowest prices. They do beat people up, and it's for their corporate profits, and that's their model. But you can get much better products at places like Costco or even local stores like the food co-op has great prices on organic food, I think. Anyway, I'm rambling. I did forget to leave out. I left one thing out that I was going to mention on this with regards to the free trade, and that was the things that if you want to protect wages and a standard of living and things like this, the you need to support investment in production. The more productivity you can get out of your efforts or whatever you do, the more you can produce with the same amount of input, the greater your income is going to be, or the greater the wealth you're going to generate is going to be. So that's what brings us our high standard of living. It's the fact that we've made our labor more productive by computerization, with using heavy equipment to build roads and things like this. Milton Friedman was once touring China, and he saw this road project, and people were doing all the work with shovels and picks and wheelbarrows. And he was asking, so why don't you guys get some backhoes and some graders? And they said, oh, well, then these people would have nothing to do. And he said, and he goes, oh, so the object you want to have full employment? He says, and he said, yes. And he said, well, take away the wheelbarrows and the shovels and picks and give them spoons.
Yeah.
So, you know, and the point is, you know, of course, no one would ever do that. It'd be foolish. It'd be much more efficient to use a wheelbarrow and a shovel and a pick, but it's a lot more efficient to use a backhoe and a road grader and all that sort of thing, a caterpillar to push the dirt and all that stuff. Those things are much more efficient. We all realize that, and we would never dream of building an interstate highway with shovels, picks, and wheelbarrows. So you shouldn't expect your industry to keep up with somebody by just doing everything with labor, because you're gonna end up with a bunch of labor that's paid almost nothing, because they're competing against labor that's using a machine to produce the same product, and they're producing many, many more versions of it mm-hmm. at the same, you know, at a much lower cost. Mm-hmm. So if you really want to have more things at lower prices, you should invest in companies that are investing in production, that aren't just getting bailout loans from the Fed. They're actually creating products that people want at prices they can afford, and have a value in the product because it's worth something. It's going to last. It's durable. I used to be in the construction industry, and I have tools from the 1970s that I used when I was, in fact, I still have a skill saw. It's a worm drive skill saw that I bought in 1975, and it works perfect still. You have to sharpen blades once in a while, but that was a great saw. And I can't stand these little cheap sidewinder things that are out there. So that's just a good tool. Is an investment, and it's something you can use the rest of your life. You don't have to buy it, every 2 or 3 years when the motor burns out. Mm-hmm. So that's all all on that subject. I think we should get into State of Jefferson history.
Sounds good, David. You've got the floor.
All righty. Well, for those of you who aren't familiar with the State of Jefferson at all, in a nutshell, it is the idea that Northern California and Southern Oregon should secede and form their own states. Now, it's actually the most well-known of these movements occurred in 1941, although the movement has been alive in one way or another since the late 1800s, it might have even been around before California and Oregon were states, and there were people in this area that wanted to have their own state. But a lot of the original names thrown around were things like the state of Klamath, the state of Shasta, things like that, more, names based on local geography. What happened in 1941, what was by far the most successful attempt at creating the state of Jefferson, all happened because Gilbert Gables, who at the time was actually an East Coaster who had moved out here years prior, and was living in Port Orford, where he got himself elected the mayor. He described himself as the hick mayor of the farthest west town in the Union. You know, got to remember at that time, Alaska and Hawaii weren't part of America. So Jefferson actually originally would have been the 49th state, not the 51st like it would be today. He sort of got the ball rolling on the movement. What happened was Northern California and also Southern Oregon, although Northern California was really the focus of the movement, they were being taxed just like everywhere is taxed. But they weren't really seeing a lot of their tax money come back to them, you know, in the form of money from the state to build roads and, you know, to build infrastructure, which, you know, we libertarians, especially us, you know, more extreme libertarians like you have hosting the show, we would probably not really want government to do those things anyway. But as long as you're being taxed, it makes sense that you want the money to at least some of it come back to you, so that you can use it for building infrastructure. All the roads, you know, around here, except for, you know, maybe Highway 99, which was the main road that is basically now I-5, all the roads were just dirt and nasty, you know, not maintained by anyone except for the people living on them, which when you have the state stealing that responsibility from people, doesn't happen. If you lived in a truly free market where people were expected to build their own roads, businesses had to maintain their roads, homeowners had to maintain their roads, I think you'd see things being maintained much better. And the problem with that was that there were a lot of resources in this area. There still are. It's a very resource-rich environment. We have lots of timber, obviously, but we also have lots of chrome and copper. And the argument from people in Northern California at the time was that, hey, you need to give us some grants so that we can, you know, develop these roads so that we can start mining the copper and mining the chrome. Their argument basically being that these were vital defense materials that were going to be needed should America enter World War II.
UCY.TV is an up-and-coming investigative media platform designed to give you a voice on the platform of your choice. Video, live radio, podcast, just to name a few. To learn more on what UCY can offer and how you can be a part of UCY.TV, simply email us at contact.ucytv@gmail.com. That's contact. UCYTV@gmail.com.
Basically what happened is mid-November, it was the idea of Gilbert Gables, mayor of Port Orford, Oregon, got some people together, and they basically came up with the idea, hey, why don't we make our own state? And at first, it was actually kind of a joke. There, you know, it was going to be just sort of a way to bring attention to their plight. And so they all got together and they started a, you know, sort of tongue-in-cheek secession movement where they were, where they would, every Thursday, they would gather on Highway 99 and form a roadblock and, you know, a bunch of guys, a bunch of cowboys out there with their shotguns, their rifles, their pistols, revolvers. They'd stand there on the road and they'd hand out little pamphlets to people who were driving through, and they would just tell them, you know, every Thursday we are going to be seceding. So hold on, I'm distracted by guests. Sorry, my grandparents are here. They're trying to say goodbye to me. Anyway, they started seceding. I had the document here, and then my internet died a second ago. I guess Drew can't hear us right now. Can you hear me, Chuck?
I can hear you, David.
Okay, sorry. I'll just go on. Sorry, folks. Just been some technical difficulties.
You're doing great.
Anyway. So they started their little secession movement. They handed out some pamphlets and just told everyone to spread the word. And before too long, they had a reporter come up from San Francisco to start working on getting the news out with them, to start writing a story about it. Here's what the State of Jefferson Proclamation of Independence that they were handing out at the roadblocks said. They first started handing these out November 27th, 1941. It said, "You are now entering Jefferson, the 49th state of the Union. Jefferson is now in patriotic rebellion against the states of California and Oregon. The state has seceded from California and Oregon this Thursday, November 27th, 1941. Patriotic Jeffersonians intend to secede each Thursday until further notice. For the next 100 miles as you drive along Highway 99, you are traveling parallel to the greatest copper belt in the far west, 75 miles west of here. The United States government needs this vital mineral, but gross neglect by California and Oregon deprives us of necessary roads to bring out the copper ore. If you don't believe us, drive down the Klamath River Highway and see for yourself. Take your chains, shovel, and dynamite. Until California and Oregon build a road into the copper country, Jefferson, as a defense-minded state, will be forced to rebel each Thursday and is a separate state. Please carry this proclamation with you and pass them out on your way." So basically what had happened is, from the time that, you know, the representatives of these border counties met in Yreka on November 17th to November 27th, when they started doing the roadblock and handing out this propaganda, it went from sort of a tongue-in-cheek joke to a full-blown secession movement. At their initial meeting...
That's in a period of 2 weeks?
A week and a half, really, 10 days.
Whoa.
What happened was they allocated $100 towards researching the idea of seceding. And, you know, kind of a side note, but $100 then is about $1,600 today, $1,500 to $1,600. And so they started looking into it. And why can't I think of the name of the reporter now? A reporter came up and he started reporting on it, and he actually died in 1988. So there's some interviews with him from long after the movement happened. Stanton Delaplane, that was his name. Stanton Delaplane died in 1988, and there's some interviews with him later in his life where he was talking about it, and he was like, "Yeah, you know, we went up there. It was." People thought it was funny. We were covering it. And all of a sudden, when we started handing out these flyers and stuff, people kind of realized, like, this is actually a really good idea. Why don't we do it? So, you know, before too long, they had elected Judge John Childs to be the first governor of Jefferson. They decided that Yreka was going to be at least the temporary state capital. They were basically setting up an entire, sovereign government so that they could secede. And unfortunately, what ended up happening was that Stanton Delaplane, the reporter, had written all these great articles. He ended up actually winning a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the secession movement. And one side note before I go on, the name Jefferson was actually chosen when they ran a contest in the local newspaper. I believe it was the Pioneer Press. It was a $2 reward, which would be about $30 today, and the Jefferson was the winning name, because before that, they were throwing around a lot of names like Californian and Middle West Coastia, and I think just the fact that they went from, you know, sort of comedic joking names like that to the state of Jefferson shows, in a way, sort of the how quickly the movement matured and turned into a serious movement. So what happened was Stanton Delaplane put out all these great articles, and they actually had a crew come up and shoot a bunch of footage documenting it. The State of Jefferson Rebellion was actually starting to pop up in newspapers all across the country. It was a great topic of interest, and now it was going to have a bona fide newsreel documenting it shown in movie theaters across the country. And that was scheduled to happen December 7th, 1941. And we all know what actually happened that day. Pearl Harbor got attacked by the Japanese. And after that, the movement just kind of got swept aside and forgotten in the maelstrom that came from that. A lot of it was that at that point the military realized, okay, and the government realized, okay, we do need these resources, and they started pumping money back into the area. I think it's really tragic that, you know, it took a war to do that. It's just, I'm sure the Keynesians would be thrilled to hear that. Before the war, the government was taxing these people and then just spending money, they were spending a lot of money on things like campgrounds, near big cities in San Francisco. They were spending money on things that everyone in the city would use, and, they were just not helping these people they are supposedly, representing to the north at all. And I think it's really sad that so many people just were like, oh, okay, well now, now we're getting the money from the government, so it's okay. And they just kind of dropped it. And the movement, just as quickly as it sprung up, it kind of died away. And what I think is really, really sad about that is that the implication is really like, we don't need you unless there's a war. You're useless to us until we can exploit you for something else.
Yeah. And I'll point out another thing that the Keynesians will point to that is how the war is leading to prosperity. All the money and investment that went into Northern California and Southern Oregon came out of somebody else's pocket, so it reduced the investment in other areas. It doesn't lead to any prosperity. It just focused it in one spot. At everybody else's expense.
Yep, that's pretty much exactly right. But that's basically the story of the state of Jefferson in a nutshell. There have been a few movements over the years to rekindle it. I think there was one in the 60s. I think a ballot measure actually made it all the way to the elections in the 90s in California to split California into three states, and of course, it went nowhere. For some reason, a lot of people are just really knee-jerk, like, oh, why would you want to do that? No, it's terrible. And we're not even at this point really talking about seceding and trying to form a sovereign nation, or even better, a stateless region. We're just talking about forming a new state. We're just talking about, instead of people from LA controlling what happens in, Siskiyou County, people between Reading and Medford basically deciding what happens there. We're just paring down the demographics a little bit. I mean, I grew up in Siskiyou County. I grew up right in the heart of where the state of Jefferson was a thing. And actually, when I was a kid is when it really first started seeing a resurgence, in like the mid-90s. All of a sudden, people started flying their flags again. And I think one of the biggest driving factors behind that was just that the government killed industry. I come from a family of loggers, and the logging industry, it's pretty much dead in Northern California. And it's all because of regulations. Today, we have the Siskiyou Crest Monument. The federal government is trying to, but environmentalists are lobbying the federal government to create a national monument on the California-Oregon border, which would drastically affect the private property rights of something like 1,500 to 2,000 private properties, parcels, which would be in that area. And that's something that's not even voted on by Congress. As if voting grants something any, moral legitimacy. It's something that would be created, with a stroke of the president's pen in an executive order. There are the whole issue. There's something like four different hydroelectric dams that the federal government, at the behest of environmentalists, want to take out, which would, to help a fish species that isn't even really endangered. And I don't think any sane people actually care about. And they're just,
I think that's wrecking. Just to help push electricity rates up so GE can make some more money.
Well, I'm sure there's some of that going on behind the scenes too. It's just they are just ruining the livelihoods of people. And all of that really started, in earnest in the mid-90s. And so you've kind of seen a resurgence of it. I mean, if you go down where I grew up on the Klamath River in Syed Valley, California, there are State of Jefferson flags. Every business, it seems, is named, you know, Jefferson State this or State of Jefferson that. The road itself, Highway 96, was sort of renamed the State of Jefferson Scenic Byway. It's a big part of the local community, and virtually everyone I know there supports it to some extent or another. You know, they're not all necessarily out campaigning for it, but I think, you know, the vast majority of them, it came down to a vote, would vote for it. They're sick of their livelihoods being destroyed by regulations. They're sick of, and it's not just logging. It's ranching, it's logging, it's mining. There's, honestly, at this point, downriver, there's not a whole lot except for Forest Service employees and, you know, growers, if you know what I mean. And people are sick of the gun laws. You know, they're sick of, in California, it was just passed, within the last 2 weeks, you really now can't be armed in California at all. Or at least, you know, you can't carry a gun. You used to, up until the beginning of this year, be able to open carry a handgun, but it had to be unloaded, so you could have an extra magazine on your belt. And then that was banned at the beginning of this year. And now they've banned long guns. Now you can't even carry around a rifle or a shotgun for your defense. And there are some exceptions. Thankfully, the part of California I grew up in, because it has a population of a county population under 200,000, it doesn't have quite the same guidelines as elsewhere. And you can just walk around in the woods with guns. But it's just incredibly frustrating to, you know, these people who live out in the middle of nowhere in the woods, these rugged individualists, to have to kowtow to a bunch of regulations that, you know,
they don't make any sense.
Right, that city slickers from San Francisco and Sacramento and L.A. basically voted for.
They might make sense in Oakland or something like that, but they don't, you know, East L.A., they don't make sense in the Siskiyou Mountains.
Mm-hmm. And it's not quite as bad here in Oregon. I don't think there's quite the vitriolic hate for the state government. Because at the end of the day, Oregon itself, for the most part, isn't any worse than the federal government is. I think there's, you know, virtually no freedom here at all. But compared to, you know, sort of the status quo, it's sort of average. So people don't notice anything. Whereas California, you know, you come across the border into Oregon and it's like a totally different place. But at the same time, there's a lot of things in Oregon that I think a lot of us would like to see changed. I mean, wouldn't you love to be able to pump your own gas again?
Yeah.
I don't even know how long that law's been in existence for, but I mean, I grew up in California and I travel quite a bit, and it kills me every time I'm, you know, out and about and I get used to pumping my own gas for a week or two, and I come back and it's people do not realize just how much time is wasted. And you go gas up anywhere else where you can pump your own gas, you never have to wait. You can be in and out and gassed up in 3 or 4 minutes. Here, it's almost always a 15 to 20 minute ordeal for me getting gas. I wait in lines behind 3 and 4 people. You know, there are just these terribly lazy bottom feeders who are trying to pump my gas. They're just standing around. There'll usually be like one guy working while 3 are on a smoke break. It blows my mind. I mean, 48 out of 50 states allow people to pump their own gas, and the sky hasn't fallen. You don't hear about people dying in tragic gasoline accidents. It's insane. It's just, you know, the nanny state run amok. And imagine how, you know, you could probably easily at least slash 10 or 15 cents a gallon off if you didn't have to pay for employees.
So, David, I think this comes under the heading of the government eating out our sustenance. That was one of the reasons cited by our founding fathers to secede from England. Here's the exact quote. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. Yes, so that's kind of what the governments in California and Oregon have done to us. They We're the redheaded stepchild in this region, and we get nothing.
Yeah, but you know, like listening to those the sheriffs in the Jefferson State speak, it's not just the state governments; it's also the federal government as well. And don't you think that when the colonies seceded, didn't they intend to be sovereign nation states? You know, I think it was the treaty with France that it looked more like a joint and several agreement, not the United States of America with all capital letters, but lowercase united, lowercase states of America. You know, it wasn't one country. It was a group of sovereign nation states, and they weren't dependent upon one another for defense or taxes, things like that. And that's where we're running into a lot of these problems with the federal government telling us how everyone is going to live across the board, or you know, like we were talking about last week, controlling public lands.
Yes, and you know, in our founding fathers, they firmly believed in secession as the ultimate tool to control the growth of government. If the government gets so oppressive that you just can't live with them, then you live without them. And at the turn of the 19th century, from about 1800 to 1812, there were three attempts of the northern states to secede into a northern confederacy, and they were brought on by the Louisiana Purchase, which the northern states, they thought that they were kind of the elite genetic population, they thought all the immigrants that would flood into the new world to populate the Louisiana Purchase would degrade the country, so they wanted to be a separate little elite part up there in the New England. And after reading that explains a lot to me. I didn't know that, but that explains a lot. There was a national embargo in 1807 that really severely hurt them. It hurt the northern states a lot more than anybody else, and they thought it was targeted at them, and so they were ready to go after that. And then the War of 1812, they didn't want to be any part of that. In fact, they refused to pay taxes to support that war. So, I mean, that was nullification. There's all these things were part of our original founding. We kind of lost track of why they were there and the usefulness and the greatness of that idea. And that was kind of all squashed in 1860. Anybody who would bring these things up was put in prison, and habeas corpus was suspended, and 660,000 Americans died in the Civil War to put these ideas to rest permanently. So we're trying to resurrect them a little bit and let people know that things can be nullified. You don't have to go along if you have the right, if natural law is on your side and you're speaking the truth. You might be arrested, you might be put in prison, but you shouldn't give up. Recently, there's been several cases where, Drew, you were calling that to our attention earlier before the show started. Juries have nullified verdicts or charges, and the people have been released.
Well, yeah, there's another guy was arrested for selling raw milk. And it's not like he was producing raw milk and selling it through grocery stores or something like that. He was selling it through a cooperative, so you know that's a private contract. You know, you've got a group of people coming together, making a deal with a farmer, and the farmer's producing raw milk. I'm on this website here, Fully Informed Jury Association. The article here says raw milk co-op farmer acquitted through jury nullification. Another article on the case of farmer Alvin Schlangen, who was acquitted by a jury on several nonviolent charges related to a raw milk distribution. Technically, Alvin was guilty of breaking the laws in question, even though the laws are totally ridiculous and unjust. Luckily, this jury was informed about the process of jury nullification and their legal right to rule in favor of the accused for breaking unjust laws. Let's see. According to Iliola Jones, I think that's a typo, director of the Fully Informed Jury Association, Minnesota has long had highly visible FIJA activists volunteering their time and efforts to educate every potential juror in Minnesota about the right of the people to veto bad laws through the use of the juror veto, or as it's commonly called, jury nullification. As laws become more and more invasive, punitive, and draconian, prison populations become more and more peopled by harmless, productive people who have harmed no other person. Jurors can stop the enforcement of bad laws. Jurors have stopped bad laws since freedom of religion was defended by jurors and by later jurors who refused to enforce slavery. We, the owners of all government, retain the peaceful, lawful right to refuse to enforce bad laws made by some judge or politician. Courageous jurors have always stood firm for the human rights of their families and neighbors by refusing to sanction bad laws. The right of the people to drink the milk of their choice and to feed their children healthy foods is a human right. There was another case in New Hampshire. A New Hampshire jury nullifies major felony marijuana case. And there was a guy as Doug Darrell. He was a 59-year-old father of four children. He was a Rastafarian piano tuner, and he grew a little weed for his own personal medical and religious use.
And heaven forbid.
Heaven forbid. Jury just thought it was ridiculous, and ultimately they came to the conclusion that he wasn't a threat to society. As a matter of fact, he made positive contributions to the community, and it would have been wrong to lock him up. So they were informed of the right to nullify the law. And so I think more and more people need to be aware of this. This is a powerful tool. And oftentimes the laws on the books weren't voted on by anybody. They were just dreamed up by bureaucrats. A lot of times governors create departments that draft lots of laws. And we are coming up on the end of the show here. We're about ready to wrap things up pretty quick. Do you guys have any other thoughts on...
Well, I have a last word about nullification.
Sure.
This is a quote from John Jay. Some of you who are history buffs may recognize that he was the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And he says, the jury has the right to judge both the law as well as the fact in controversy, which means that if the law stinks, they don't have to go by the law. They have a right that's above that. They are above the law. That's my last words.
Good words from John Jay. Thank you, Chuck. And everyone, thanks for tuning in tonight. You've been listening to Double Cross Radio on UCY.TV. We'll be back next Thursday from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. You can tune in at UCY.TV. We'll try to get this out as a podcast and uploaded to YouTube and passed around Facebook. We had some technical difficulties tonight, so hopefully everybody had their recorders running so we could splice some things together. And that is a wrap. I want to thank you guys, David and Chuck, for coming on tonight, and I look forward to doing this again soon.
Yep. Thank you. As always.